Eric, how are you doing, man?
Hey, Josh, how are you doing?
Good. So I know you're running, but I had to get you on camera. It's been a while. What's going on? What's your latest?
Well, look at this. Look at these guys here. These are the heroes of RX.
Absolutely.
That's you, Bart.
And, right on.
Yeah, they have done some awesome work, so I think the Channel 9ers will love it. So.
Absolutely.
All right.
Right on.
I'll be back.
Yes, you will, man.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Nice to see you, buddy. Matthew. So,
yes, sir.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
It's been way too long. In fact, last time you were on Channel 9, we were doing an expert-to-expert with you, remember?
Yes, that was on F-sharp and monads.
That fun stuff.
Gosh, that was a while ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And, of course, you've been very busy working on RxJS.
Correct.
Which we're happy to announce is shipping in some form?
Yes, so we have it on NuGet, and we have it on MSDN, MSDN Download Center, and we've made a considerable effort on putting a lot of our stuff out on GitHub as well, including a reference of the reactive extensions for JavaScript so that people can understand, debug, etc., their applications. So it's been a kind of a long ride to get there, but I'm pretty proud of where we are. Documentation is always something that I feel can be improved, and I'm working on that. But overall, I'm pretty pleased about where we are. I'm driving a lot of the community stuff, making sure documentation's up, seeing what people are using it for. So.
How's RxJS being used in the real world? So are people adopting it on web pages and stuff like that and taking advantage of the power of...
I think so. I get emails every so often from people saying that I'm using it for, you know, the simple things that that RxJS is really good at. For example, the throttling of the input doing. I've seen people write games and so forth in it. So a lot of the things that require a little bit more coordination than simple event processing or simple... XML, HTTP request, and AJAX sorts of things, absolutely, there is a bit of interest there.
Excellent. Now, of course, we have Bart J.F. DeSmet, and of course, that's all I'm going to call you from now on,
that
that's your real name, mm-hmm. You know, because it's actually quite cool.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent a lot of time, and people already have watched this by now, on your RX for PowerShell.
Yes.
And some other amazing work you've been doing in terms of performance tuning and stuff like that.
That's going on, yes.
That's going on, and always goes on.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you a question in terms of implementation details. So how are the implementation of RX C# mm-hmm. and RX JS similar?
Pretty similar, actually.
Yeah.
Like really?
Yeah,
the code base is pretty much, you know, the same. It's just like different syntax and no locks.
Exactly. For the most part, the code transfers over very, very well.
Hmm.
And once again, if you're using C#, you still get the nice curly braces that everyone expects. And instead of lambdas, you have to use the keyword function and everything else. But for the most part, outside of... A few minor little things, transfers over quite well. There are of course a little differentiations between say the C# version and the JavaScript version. I'm just going to lowercase the operators to make it actually feel more JavaScripty than what Jeffrey and I had done before for RxJS, the initial version.
Mm.
So that took a little bit more work than just a simple rename. There was a bit of renaming involved in terms of some of the operators now collided with reserved words.
Returning cash.
Exactly. Return becomes return value, catch becomes catch exception, finally becomes finally due, and so forth, that there had to be a little bit of a mapping that had to be done. But for the most part, I'm pretty happy with where we are.
Cool. Now, what about, one of the foundations of RX, obviously, is Link, which is a language feature of C#, and certainly not of JavaScript.
Right.
So how does Link work in JavaScript?
It's no more than the simple extension method kind of syntax that you would have. really not much different than what you would do where you would say something to observable dot where dot select and so forth.
Okay, interesting. Very nice. So one of the cool things about JavaScript is the ability to add a lot of extensions and prototypes and stuff like that. It's quite powerful in that way. Anyway, I'm here to talk to you today specifically about what's new in this version of RxJS. Mm-hmm. Because people are going to be downloading this, what should they be looking for?
Well, of course, we've already talked a little bit about the renames, but there were a few obvious signature changes between what was in version 1 and the version 1.1, SP1, in that, gosh, there was quite a few renames.
Well, we have a few things that have to do with overloads, right?
Yes. Yeah,
like buffer, you know, historically we had buffer with count, buffer with time, buffer with timer count. And
yeah, and adding in the
.NET, we said like overloading is the way to go because in .NET you can do overloading. And so in RxJS, like in certain cases, overloading doesn't quite work because you need to do argument checking and stuff.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So in those cases, we still have different names from the .NET API just to disambiguate between different cases.
Yeah, so I would have, as well as we would add in the windowing operators such as window with time, window with timer counts, etc. So all of those particular operators are new. We've decided to split up the files a little bit in terms of keeping the core as small as possible and then moving the time-based operators such as the throttles, the timeouts, the anything that uses the set timeout mechanism of the browser or set immediate or whatever, we would move out to its own. Aggregates are in their own. The group join is something. The group join stuff is brand new. So now we have group join and join. We also have the join patterns, off in its own place, nicely redesigned. So there's a lot of changes, and not only that, but I completely ported all of the RX.NET tests for RxJS, so we have now verified behavior that it not only looks like the same C# code, but it actually acts the same way as well, that the semantics from from .NET work exactly the way it does on JavaScript.
Excellent. Now, the question I would have for you next is, given the number of virtual machines out there that actually execute JavaScript versus the one you have for C# plus the mono world, what's that like in terms of if you have a very complex RxJS application, do you have issues with how Rx is interpreted and compiled and stuff like that? Have you noticed performance degradation?
No, thankfully not. We rely very, very little on the browser or the JavaScript runtime itself. There are very few places. For example, in the one of the timeout scheduler obviously uses the browser's or Node.js's set timeout mechanism. But that's about it. In terms of, that's the only time you really touch the window or global object at all.
Yeah, that's pretty similar, in fact, to the way that Rx and .NET is layered, right? Like, the notion of schedulers can be platform specific. Like, you have the immediate scheduler, the current thread scheduler. Those just work everywhere because they just piggyback on the current threads. But if you do time-based operations, even in .NET, well, on Silverlight, you have the dispatcher scheduler with, you know, the dispatcher timer. On WinForms, you have a different thing. On, like, a cloud scheduler, you might have something totally else as well. So there, the iScheduler abstraction comes into play. And in fact, due to the refactoring that we did in RxJS, you have a similar situation where the browser dependencies are cut off in terms of an iScheduler implementation that uses set timeout. And so you can really nicely cut up the API and say, like, this stuff is browser specific, this stuff is specific to, like, using, I don't know, like the HTML DOM, like the from events patterns and those kind of things. Like, so it's easy to have an Rx core which is kind of purely functional, like, you know, lots of functions, lots of closures, like creating observable objects, really. And that pipeline is independent of using certain schedulers or certain DOM bridges or whatever, and those can be separated out. So it's something that's portable as long as, you know, all the virtual machines support closures and memory, you know, allocation patterns and all those things, and they should, otherwise they're fundamentally bust attacks.
But there are a lot of execution strategies that some of these machines employ.
Sure.
So, I mean, if you look at Chrome, for example, they do some pretty interesting, pretty smart, interesting performance enhancement tricks, as does Chakra and as does Safari, blah, blah. I was just curious. So what are some of the hardest problems you had to kind of crunch on? Be like, how do we get this thing that we already have working in C-sharp, working in this new world of JavaScript? Not new world, but it's a very different world.
Yeah.
That's my question. It took me 40 seconds to get it out. I'll edit that down.
Well, some of the differences have been where obviously I want to keep the overload semantics still intact, meaning either I accept a particular object, such as an observer, or I accept a set of functions of on next, on error, and on completed. So there's a good number of flexible ways in JavaScript to do argument checking and seeing if it's a function versus an object. So those are some of the trade-offs that I had to make. Mm. That, and I think one of the larger concerns, obviously, with client-side programming is the size. Is how do you do the same, give the same level of functionality, but yet cut down the size to an absolute minimum? Because even with our mobile platforms, it still matters. Performance still matters, and if you can shave off a few bytes here and there, it makes all the difference in the world. So there were a lot of times when I was really scratching my head and saying, "How can I make this work in a smaller form than it is right now in the .NET version?" Mm. And you know, some of the things that we're thinking about for V2 that I'm going to have to kind of re-examine if there are shortcuts that I can take.
Sure. Now, from a performance standpoint, how's it do? How's it stack up to the compiled version?
Oh gosh, I think we would have to.
Do you guys ever like geek out at night and see who can go faster?
Well, for the RX.NET one, I'm currently, making my head on like logs and all of those things.
So yeah, I don't have such concerns.
So for an next release, you will see nice things there.
Yeah. So for example, we do ship. Ship is a loose term. We do have our Node.js bindings that are available. On our GitHub Reactive Extensions page, and for there I could probably run some pretty interesting benchmarks in terms of file reads, file writes, etc., just to kind of get some sort of real benchmarks that I could publish. And then, Bart and I can then argue around 2 o'clock in the morning who's right.
Yeah.
I think, one of the ways that we designed RX1.0 is correctness first, right? Like, you know, we had semantics that we had to flesh out for, like, iObserver of T, how does the disposal work, like, all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So we went on the conservative road, in some sense, in RX1.0,
yeah.
And a lot of operators, like, you know, in the functional high-priest sense, you know, you can define one operator in terms of five others, right? And now that I'm doing like some performance work for RX2, which we'll talk about in a separate interview at some point, there is definitely the concern that like chaining together like five functions in order to make another function often sort of goes at the cost of some performance. And so I'm inlining a lot of things there, which reduces GCs and all of those things. And some of those concerns also carry over to JavaScript, like the number of object allocations, it's something that puts stress on any virtual machine.
Sure.
Like if you do an aggregate, and for every step in the aggregation, you allocate a new object with a count and a sum. Like, for a million elements, it's a million allocations. Whereas if you mutate a little piece of data somewhere, it's easier. But then that goes against, the flow of, size. Size will go up if you start inlining a lot of things. And so it's a different trade-off. For desktop platforms, RX is, 600K or something, or 700K. Maybe that can go up, 50K or 100K and get performance, a factor 3x or 4x, which we're seeing in certain cases right now in the workflow in vNext. But in JavaScript, there's a different dynamic where you say, like, you know, the size is more important in terms of download size and those kind of things. So we'll have to see how much of the optimizations in Rx.NET we take over and actually are relevant in the JavaScript world, yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
Like, some of them may not be a concern based on how you use things. So some things remain to be seen there.
Excellent. And so, I mean, since you've been working in JS for a while now.
Yeah, gosh, it's been years in terms of professionally. I mean, it's going back to probably 97 off and on since then. So, yeah, it's. But I didn't really pick it up as a kind of a more full-time gig until, say, Ajax became a little bit more prevalent. It was mostly kind of the glue code that was kind of the, I can do this, it's I have to do it here, and you just put it on the, you just inline it into the HTML and those sorts of things. But it wasn't until 2005, 2006 when JavaScript as a standalone really started becoming interesting on its own again. Through Ajax and so forth, and then fast forward through time, then the libraries started coming out, the jQuerys, Dojos, prototypes, and so forth, that made a lot of the browser inconsistencies that you had to deal with a lot less of a concern. So then you could really understand and enjoy the essence of the JavaScript language instead of what was really bad about that was not necessarily the language, but it was the DOM implementations and the variance between the different browser vendors.
Absolutely. And, I mean, it is interesting. And, I mean, I talked to Brendan Eich recently, and it seems like the language is actually moving forward, at least in planning stages, to more become more of a modern programming language.
Absolutely.
And that should be interesting. So now, how does, you mentioned one of the cool things about JavaScript rather than sheer number of libraries out there,
mm-hmm.
Some of them really useful. How do you interoperate with, jQuery?
Yeah, so we ship, like I said, we have a number of our bridges to other libraries such as jQuery, MooTools, Dojo, and Node.js, mm-hmm. and so forth. We shipped quite a few before, but honestly, I can only support so much in so much time without letting the community kind of drive that kind of adoption, and I think that's really key there. But going to the jQuery side, so we have the standard event bindings, whether it's using the on method, or it's using bind, or delegate live is not really supposed to be used anymore. But then you have all the other ones like click, double click, and so forth. And so we basically appended as observable onto them so that you can kind of jump to there. And as well as the particular pieces around the Ajax rewrite that jQuery did in the 1.4, 1.5 time frame, where they started exposing promise objects, so you can say get products dot then and handle the success and completion. We have interop with that. So we have that. We have callbacks as well, deferred objects, and so forth. So full interop with all of those things. And if there are any other things that I'm missing, the great thing about this project is it's open, it's out there. If you want to suggest something, add something, well, it's an open repository. Knock yourself out.
That's great.
Yeah, and the more bindings, the merrier, right?
Exactly.
Like, it's like, in the .NET framework, there's a different set of economics there, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you have task of T, you have the begin and invoke pattern,
mm-hmm.
which all go towards the async features.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a single value asynchrony. That's a problem that's not solved in JavaScript yet. Like, you have so many ways to do promises, and like, you know, HX has a different pattern, and like, it's all different patterns.
Mm.
We're unifying those using iObserver of T, well, without the of T part in JavaScript, really. But that's what's going on there. And like, the number of bindings that are different is far higher than in for example, .NET. And .NET, you could do it, like we have, for example, RxX, which is a great community project by James Miles and Dave Sexton, two of our superstars. And they have done a similar effort for, like, some of the .NET things, like HTTP client has, like, a lot of extension methods now that expose things as iObservable. You know, SMTP client has it too. And we see very similar things in the JavaScript community where you have a lot of APIs that have some form of asynchrony.
Yes.
And the patterns are not the same. So, like, unifying those, like, you know, if you have your favorite library, you say, oh my god, I wish I could use Rx for that. Well, you know, in .NET, you would just write an extension method. In JavaScript, well, you just extend, you know, the object or whatever and just, you know, share it with the community. It's totally out there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very much so. And then you look at some of the larger, more encompassing libraries, you know, whether it's underscore or even some of the more MVC libraries such as the Backbones, Angulars, and Spines. Gosh, how many other are there out there? Knockouts. And you go into Hacker News, you'll find a new one every day.
So it's an itch ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just like, quite honestly, you'll find a new asynchronous library every single day as well. And if you go on to NPM, the Node Package Manager, you'll find kind of the same thing, that everyone still wants to do their own style of async taming where they're not having all of their callbacks just walk completely off the screen. So the best thing for us to do is to put ourselves out there to make bindings available, and not only that, but show how it's done, so therefore if the community really wants to take it to that next level, it's fairly trivial.
Excellent.
I think a key differentiator to bring it up here is, like, a lot of people seem to make, like, asynchronous, you know, abstractions, because, well, that seems to be a nicer pattern, or that seems to be a nicer pattern. But, like, if you look at Rx, that's one of the things we do with the bindings, is, like, convert existing sources of asynchrony to, like, a common pattern being observable sequences. But then the nice thing we add on top of that is, like, once you're in that world, you have all those query capabilities. Like, you have all those standard query operators, you have throttling, you have, like, time-based operations, and a lot of other libraries that try to unify asynchrony just do it to make the syntax look common. Like, the same way of approaching different asynchronous programming models, but putting a library on top of that that does, like, complex event processing based on that single abstraction is really where the value comes in. It's like to glue all of those things together and have rich things like, you know, where filters, projections, groupings, all of those things.
So this brings up an interesting point. I mean, when you think about how JavaScript is being used today, now, don't get me wrong, I mean, it's a language that Microsoft is built into our next operating system as a first-class citizen for building apps.
Yep.
I think that's very impressive, whether or not people have wrapped their heads around the fact that you can make an HTML5 Windows app yet. Yeah. I don't know. Seems to me to be pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
But talk to me about how it's being used. Like, where do you see this? The power of Rx is, as you just said, event stream processing.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me about how it's, like, without giving away specific details of things that may not be public, but in general, I'm a web developer.
Yeah.
When am I going to use Rx versus when I would just use XML HTTP or jQuery's implementation, or, you know,
and that's a good question, is when do you get to that certain point? Because for the most part, some people are going to just use a simple key up, and then they're going to make an HTTP request. And the difference, of course, where we come from is to say that those two things are largely the same thing. They are a stream of values, or something like that. And that if you need no more composition than that, then then fine, stick with what you're doing. But if you're going to get into the more interesting streaming stuff, like, for example, if you're going to use the Twitter streaming APIs to do real-time analysis and crunching, would it really make sense to use some of those libraries? Probably not as much when you've got buffering and windowing and aggregation operators that make a lot of sense. For things like Node, for example, it's where it's shoved onto the very edge. You're allowed to do complex events processing and using RxJS to do a lot of the calculations for you, which just makes a lot of sense.
Agreed.
Yeah, it's a very similar world, I think, to like the world in .NET sites. Like they say, you know, I have a UI application, for example, and you have a text change defense. Well, if you're just going to update another label, like, would you convert the event to an iObservable and then do subscribe on that, or just hook up an event handler? Likely, would just do the event handler at that point. If you do an asynchronous request inside the event handler, well, maybe you want to see that asynchronous request as a stream as well. Then maybe you want to convert the event into an iObservable, the asynchronous request in an iObservable, and use, like, from select or, like, select many or... and you have the built-in syntax to glue the things together. At the same time, now we have async event handlers in .NET 4.5, so like it's also a case where it's not completely clear whether you really want to go to an iObservable at that point. But then as soon as you start having the input sequence, like, you know, the text box inputs being a sequence that's really very chatty because the user is really typing really fast, like, as soon as you want to add something that looks trivial, like, for example, filter duplicates of user input or total the sequence based on some time-based operation, well, you're lost in paradise. You know, like, you can start a timer and do cancellation and all sorts of crazy things. And at that point, it's a tipping point for you to say, like, a classic event handler is not what I want. At that point, I want to go to an iObservable and convert it into, you know, a sequence and apply some operators on it. And it just depends on, like, whether or not you want to do complex things on top of the sequence. But as soon as you start being in that world, like, it's easy to add things to it. Like, you have a little bit of work to do to get into the iObservable space, but then, like, oh my god, now I can filter on inputs that are, you know, longer than 5 characters, like just the where clause. Like, no more if somewhere that needs to be buried deep inside the code or anything like that. So that's where it sort of shines. It's like at some point you see a tipping point for your problem set. Like if it's just doing a window alert on a text changed event, likely iObservable is not what you want to go for. Mm-hmm. As soon as you have multiple sources of async and you need to coordinate those things, that definitely makes sense to bridge into iObservables and
certainly
and use the link setup operators. Yes.
Yeah. And it is interesting that for example, WinJS has a notion of promises, so that, for example, all the XML HTTP requests that go through WinJS happen to also be promise objects, so you can do the then and then be able to handle errors in a uniform way as well as success and progress and so forth. And going back and forth between that world and RxJS is actually fairly simple. But going back to Bart's point, it really is that first layer of, oh, okay, now I need to add an if statement because I want this particular thing. Requirements change, I need to also do this. So there's no real composability to it. It's just you're slapping more into this one gigantic if statement or passing
or
in another
distinct things,
yes,
or dictionary or something,
yes,
like.
or pass things into a filter function, and you keep on adding more filter functions,
yeah.
or whatever, and that doesn't even get into the more interesting aspects of aggregation or anything like that, or even more time-based semantics.
Yeah.
So as soon as you hit that first wall, it gets very difficult very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
And even for single value asynchronous operations, like you might say, I know promise just does the job or task of t just does the job. Well, that's true when you start doing little things, but like, for example, converting in the .NET version a task to an iObservable, you might say, well, why do you want to do that? Like a task is just a single value source. Well, if you want to do a timeout, well, you have two options. You can say convert it to an observable and do dot timeout, or stay in the world of the promises and then try to create, you know, a task that has the value and then a task.delay and then do when any between the two things and check all the indexes that came back to see whether it was the timeout or the other thing. How do you cancel the other thing? Like, it's a lot of imperative code, imperative fluff, if you will, to get to that point. And that's the same with, like, you know, simple promises you might have, you know, one promise that gets your value back, and then you want to do a set timeout to do some timeout, and then one thing arrives, and how do you cancel the existing thing, or how do you make sure the continuation doesn't run because it was a cancellation first? Like, if you just go to Rx, you say, I have the promise, I convert it to an observable, I do dot timeout on it, all problem solved. Like, you get an exception flowing out in case there was a timeout, and we cancel the thing at the same time. So it's really very compositional at that point. Like, and then the next thing is, you might say, well, I want to delay the whole thing with 2 seconds. Well, don't delay 2 seconds, and you're done. If you want to do that in some other world, it's a hell of a lot more work to accommodate for that.
As soon as you hit that set timeout barrier, then you know your host.
The code is inside out, yeah.
Yes.
Yes, well, I think as JavaScript developers are quite used to set timeout.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That used to be a canonical one to solve timing bugs in various browser versions.
Yeah.
I remember that clearly.
Rather, it's even set timeout 0 just to say, okay, we're just going to shift.
The amount of time it takes to just to call the function
is 20 milliseconds.
It's enough.
Yes, 20 milliseconds or whatever that is, that that's no matter what you do, it's going to do that, yeah.
So I'm going to ask, I mean, how are JavaScript, I mean, I don't know what the numbers are. I mean, I keep hearing things like there's most code being written today is JavaScript. If you think about, like, the amount of code actively being written today. And you see different things. I mean, C is still on the top. I'm not getting into that kind of battle, whatever, because it's not interesting. Sure. What I am curious about is the canonical web developer, the JavaScript developer, the person who builds web pages.
Yep.
How are they wrapping their heads around this Rx model? Are you seeing a large ramp? Up ramp time? Are you seeing that it kind of blended nicely in with the semantics of the language? What's going on here?
Well, I certainly tried to match it with the semantics. I mean, I'll be honest. There is obviously a learning curve, just as there is with any other library. For example, how long did it take for the average .NET developer to understand what link gave them? Not just link to SQL, but just link to objects, link to XML, etc. That there is a little bit of a learning barrier, especially when you start now saying, well, what we're going to do is we're going to take the same concepts, but it's now asynchronous, meaning those values are going to get pushed at you instead of pulled. For a JavaScript developer, especially nowadays, they're very, very used to callbacks. It's just the way of life there. So you'll have, you know, a function within there. You'll have a nested function. But what hasn't been always easy, and which is why you have the 20,000 other async libraries, is everyone wants to kind of do it slightly differently and so forth. And by us unifying a lot of the events and XML HTTP request stuff, I think it's a nicer model, and I think that they are finding that it is a lot nicer because we've unified the two concepts.
Mm-hmm. Good. I mean, that's sort of the same story that you Rx.NET people tell.
Yeah. Well, in the Rx.NET world, there's some kind of difference there, maybe, in terms of what the barrier is for people.
Sure.
Like, if you see, for example, like observable create, which takes in a lambda and needs to return a lambda, like, it's a lot of lambdas, and the average C# developer, like, you know, till the point we came up with link, like, you know, callbacks were sort of an esoteric thing to do, like, it's not the way of life. In JavaScript, it's become the way of life, and in fact, if you're a .NET developer and you never got accustomed to, like, lambdas for callbacks, actually C# 5.0 will actually rescue you. You don't have to know that there are callbacks going on when you use await. So So sort of for that audience, like the notion of callbacks and the notion of delegates and events is something that sort of is harder to get, because like it's not necessary to for your way of life. Even if you do a UI program, like you double click the button and something is hooking up the delegate to the event and just get a method and you write your code. Like if you don't want to see the lambdas, you don't have to see them typically. So that's where sort of part of the Rx adoption curve in .NET comes from. It's like, yeah, you're chaining functions together, lots of little functions, and that's using lambda expansions. And in JavaScript, well, people have always used function as a keyword and have curly braces and all of those things. So there are some kind of differences in terms of like what the stumbling blocks are for people to get over.
Sure. Well, I mean, some could argue that JavaScript is a functional programming language. I don't know that everyone would agree with that, but it certainly has functional characteristics.
Absolutely.
I mean, and functions are first class.
That's true, sure.
And everything, we can't program in the language without a function. It won't do anything.
Right.
So it's interesting. I mean, I think it's really cool that you guys have. One of the things I love about the Rx team is you just never had the plan to focus on one implementation targeting one runtime or one language or one group of developers. And so it's really nice to see that you guys have shipped, with a lot of the work done by dear Matthew here, a real industrial strength version of Rx for JavaScript developers. Yeah. I'd love to see some demos.
Yeah.
Some screencasts, something where you're teaching us with code.
Sure, absolutely.
In addition to these conversational pieces, which are always fun.
Yeah.
It's
nice to get up here and hand wave and all of that, but the proof absolutely is in the code itself. And that is something that I'm working on right now, especially with Bart while I'm here, is saying, well, what's the compelling nature of what we're doing here? Mm-hmm. And for example, he and I were going back and forth on showing how supremely awful a dictionary suggest kind of scenario is without using Rx in terms of how do you handle cancel, how do you filter, how do you project, how do you do any number of these sorts of things, and then take that and then say make an XML HTTP request to something. It's a canonical example, and we've talked about that enough here, but it's enough of a compelling one to say that really it does apply to a lot of other things.
Sure.
I think that outside of the documentation is definitely where a lot of focus needs to be.
Absolutely, and I think one of the things we tend to do in this industry in general is when new libraries are invented and new technologies are invented and they're really super cool, yet they're also similar to something else but different.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't use it in this circumstance, but you could.
Right.
And so I want to finish this interview with the new style of questions that I ask on Channel 9.
Okay.
And I want the answer from both of you. And I'm going to start with you, unfortunately. Actually, I should start with him because it's not an easy question.
All right, go for it.
So I'm going to start with you, Bart, Mr. Rx himself over here.
Okay.
Rx is the answer.
Uh-huh.
What's the question?
How to orchestrate event streams and asynchronous programming.
Beautiful.
In a functional way.
In a functional way.
Yes. Functional style composition as opposed to curly braces and semicolons.
Like. And why is that? Why is that important?
It's easier for composition. Like, you know, you start in an iObservable. You do some operations. You still have an iObservable. And now you have the other guy in another library saying, if you give me a stream of points, I can visualize them on a map. Well, if you want to do that, you know, in a classic world where you have, like, the GPS sensor and then you want to filter out the things that are close to Seattle, all of a sudden you're in the la-la land of imperative world. You say, like, if the geo-coordinates are between Seattle, then I have a match. But now you're in your if statement. You're already in the event handler. How do you raise a new event that gives you a point near Seattle so you can pass it to the other port?
Call the event delegate method.
Yeah, you would have to create a wrapper event that you can, you know, so it's a lot of state and things
going on.
It's insanity. Yeah. Like, how do you cancel, how do you dispose, all of those things. Now, in Rx, you say, I have the geolocation thing, I do a where filter on it, and it's still an event stream. And now I can pass it to that Bing map service that visualizes it or whatever. Like, it's just, you have a concept, you do operations, you have the same concept back, and you just chain everything together using little functions.
Awesome.
So that's where the value comes
from. Excellent answer, and it's really cool because last time I talked to Brian Beckman on the Channel 9 interview over Christmas, he's exactly using RX for this exact problem.
Yes. Yeah.
At least in the example he showed.
In the big maps world.
Yes. That's a beautiful thing. So, you know, from the RxJS and from the Matthew perspective,
okay.
RX is the answer. What's the question?
From the JavaScript. Well, let's think about this here. Because, I mean, I would certainly say that it was just as it is for .NET. It's the unification of an event-based model versus a callback model. They're all callbacks in terms of whether one's a single value or a multiple value events, such as mouse moves versus XML HTTP requests. It's nice to have a single model to reason about both of them, so that you can. So, for example, you can filter out your mouse moves. You can filter out your geolocation moves on your browser. Any number of those things, as well as using that same exact model to make an XML HTTP request to something else, get that data in, and take it from another data source, all using the same model, so you don't have to context switch to say, oh, this library over here uses a promise, and this one over here uses some weird callback, and then I have to deal with the browser inconsistencies with events. Mm-hmm. Any number of those things. What you do is you provide a smooth surface for communicating on all of those things as a single interface.
Excellent. Well, you guys are making great progress. It's been really nice to see how RX has evolved over the years.
Yep.
And we'll continue to come and visit you.
Yep. Next time we'll likely talk about RxV2.
I hope so. I can only imagine what kind of stuff is going on, man.
Fantastic stuff.
I bet.
Sure.
Right on. Yeah. Hey, Matthew, thanks for joining us and taking
Thank
the time.
You.
And I look forward to seeing, you know, your continued evolution of RxJS in addition to some more documentation and samples. And let's see how people use it in the real world.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
Great.
Cheers.